The following presentation was recorded live by HAudio.com.
The presentation I'm going to do now is called The Seven Wonders of Jewish History. And where it fits into discovery, in terms of the, you all remember from this morning, the nuclear reactor, the spy example, you did that, right? Okay, so this is outside verification. Anyone remember from the nuclear reactor example what outside verification was? Right, it's some information outside the spy's message, reconnaissance photographs, things like that, satellites, troop movements around the nuclear reactor. Okay, so in this case, we're going to look at history as outside verification for the Torah. And I want to begin the class by telling you an interesting story that took place in the 17th century. A conversation took place between Louis XIV, the King of France, and Blaise Pascal, who's a French Enlightenment philosopher. And Louis XIV, King of France, asks Blaise Pascal for proof of the supernatural. And what does Pascal answer? He says, "The Jewish people, Your Majesty." Interesting. I mean, what's so supernatural about the Jewish people? We invented bagels. I mean, in Pascal's mind, the fact that the Jewish people survived until the 17th century was a supernatural phenomenon that violated all the laws of history. Can you imagine what he would say to see that we've made it now all the way through to the 21st century? He'd be that much more impressed. So what we're going to be looking at is really expanding on what Pascal was commenting on. Now, we call the class the Seven Wonders because we say Jewish history is made up of a series of trends. Each and every one of them is unique or very unusual. Why do we pick the number seven? Well, those of you who know a little about Judaism, those seven is a very mystical number. But also, anyone know in the ancient world, there were seven wonders of the ancient world? Anyone know any of them?
Ephesus is one of them.
The library in Ephesus, right? Hanging Gardens of Babylon, right?
Pyramid.
Okay, if you get all seven, we'll give you a refund on the discovery or something like that, you know? There are actually more than seven unique aspects of Jewish history, but we have limited time and limited attention span, so we choose to focus on seven. Now, every one of these seven, again, I said, is either highly unusual, meaning maybe happened to one or two people in human history, or in the case of what we're going to see now, many of the seven wonders are totally unique, meaning they happened only to the Jewish people. Now, to be a people with a national history that has one or two unique or unusual things in it is pretty unusual. Most histories of most peoples follow a pretty much a normal, predictable pattern. What we're going to see in Jewish history is it violates all the laws. Almost every aspect of Jewish history is very unusual, very unique. In and of itself, that's a very interesting presentation. The totally unique and weird side of Jewish history. It just stands out like a flashing light. But what's most amazing is, as unusually unique and seemingly unpredictable as Jewish history is, it was all predicted. Where is it predicted? Right, you open the Torah, our Bible, and you look inside, and there are hundreds and hundreds of what we call prophecies. Okay, predictions about what will be in the future. And we now living thousands of years after the book was written and given can see that those predictions either have come true or certainly are in the process of coming true. So what do we have? Unique, totally unusual, yet predicted, coming true. That's the seven wonders. Okay, now how's the class going to work? For each of the seven wonders, everyone has a book, right? You all have books? You don't have to open them yet. Hold on. For each of the seven wonders, what we'll do is first we'll go, I'll write it on the board, what the wonder is. We'll go inside the book, see where it is predicted. Then we'll look, is it unusual or unique? Has it happened? And most interestingly of all, does it fit together logically? And I think by the end you'll appreciate how totally supernatural and really wonderful Jewish history is. Okay? So far, so good? So to begin with, idea number one. One of the earliest predictions you see anywhere in the Bible is the idea of an eternal nation. Where does this appear as a prediction? If you go to page 52, we'll read the quotes in English. Any of you whose Hebrew is good enough, you're welcome to read along in Hebrew and check our translation skills. If you look at page 52, quote number one, this is Genesis 17:7, God speaking to the proto-Jew, Abraham, right? Spiritual grandfather of all of us. And what does great Abraham? What does God say to Abraham in Genesis 17:7? "And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations, an eternal covenant to be your God and the God of your descendants after you." So God says to Abraham, "Abraham, between you and I is going to be a permanent relationship. And since you're not going to live forever, that relationship will be perpetuated through your progeny, us, the Jewish people." God promises there will always be a Jewish people. And what's most interesting is in this particular agreement that God has between us and him, he says, no matter what the Jewish people do, I promise you'll always survive. Look at quote number 2, Leviticus 26, 44 through 45. Thus, even while they're in the land of their enemies, I will not reject nor obliterate them, lest I break my covenant with them by destroying them. For I am the Lord their God. I will remember them because of the covenant I made with their original ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations so that I might be their God. So for better or for worse, they'll always be a Jewish people. Interesting. Now, what we're going to see as we go on is that we're not the only people from the ancient world to survive to modernity. By the way, most, as we'll see in a few minutes, most nations of the ancient world didn't make it. Easily 90% plus. But what's unique about our survival is we're the only ancient nation still around that you'll find all kinds of great minds commenting on that our survival is supernatural. What do I mean? Go back to page 50. A couple of famous people that I'm sure you all know commenting on the Jewish people. Number one is quote number 3, Mark Twain. Famous American writer about 100 years ago died. Real name was? Anyone know? Right, Samuel Clemens, author of Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer. By the way, Mark Twain was an agnostic. What's an agnostic? Right, he's not an atheist. He doesn't say I don't believe, but he's a skeptic. So look at Mark Twain, the skeptic. Look at this letter from 1899 from Harper's Magazine. What does Mark Twain say? Look at the second paragraph where it says the Egyptian. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, and the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Interesting. Everything comes and goes. The greatest empires in history, we outlast them all. Okay, put that in the back of your mind. Go to quote number 1. Here's a contemporary of Mark Twain from a different part of the world. Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy, one of my personal favorites, having been a Russian language and literature major in college. He, unlike Twain, he's a writer like Twain, but he's a religious Eastern Orthodox Christian, and he's the author of some of the great works of fiction, like War and Peace. I highly recommend it if you have a few free years of reading time. It's like four times the size of the Manhattan phone book, but it's a great book. Right, look at the last paragraph of quote number 1. Look what Leo Tolstoy has to say almost 100 years ago. The Jew is the emblem of eternity. He whom neither slaughter nor torture of thousands of years could destroy. He whom neither fire, nor sword, nor inquisition was able to wipe off the face of the earth. He who was the first to produce the oracles of God. He who has been for so long the guardian of prophecy and who transmitted it to the rest of the world. Such a nation cannot be destroyed. The Jew is as everlasting as is eternity itself. So we already see Pascal, Twain, Tolstoy, all commenting on Jewish survivals somehow supernatural, against all the odds. I think you'll see by the end of the presentation why these people and many others are so impressed by the fact that we're still around. Okay, now I'd like to digress for just a couple of minutes and talk about a topic which is really important to understand to make sense of the rest of the presentation. So clear your minds, do a little bit of a historical digression. It's interesting, you know, up until about 200 years ago, maybe a little later, mid-19th century, everyone pretty much in the Western world, when I say West, I also mean Middle East, Jews, Muslims, Christians, pretty much everyone believed that the Bible was the word of the infinite creator of the universe, dictated to the Jewish people through Moses, the five books of Moses, which is the dictation of God, the word of the infinite creator of the universe. It's a pretty heavy idea, which certainly explains why the Bible is the biggest seller in all of human history, 3,000 years on the New York Times bestseller list before there was even a New York Times, and hands down, the most impactful, influential book in human history, the Word of God. And then what do we have in history in terms of the intellectual development of Europe? 18th century, the mid-19th century is a period of time that corresponds with the Enlightenment, right? French Revolution, 1789. And the Enlightenment, you guys study world history at some point? Remember, the Enlightenment was a big switch in how people looked at themselves and the world and religion. you know, in medieval period, the world, the Christian world, was very deeply steeped in religion. By the time we get to the Enlightenment, the human being has replaced God as the center of all things. Rationalism is the motto of the Enlightenment. Everything has to be understood logically. And many of the enlightened minds of 150 years ago looked at religion as a cop-out. Religion was invented by primitive people who didn't have science. That's how they explained the unexplainable, when they couldn't understand the world logically. People heard this idea before? So for the first time in human history, we have the birth of a powerful secular counterculture to religion. Religion's a cop-out. Everything comes under the scrutiny of these great enlightened minds. Now, a lot of good things come out of the Enlightenment. The growth of liberal democracy, the rise of literacy, the industrialization of the Western world, you name it. But on the negative side, to a large extent, we have a huge backlash against religion, against the idea of God, organized religion, and against the Bible. And out of the Enlightenment in the 19th century comes a school of academic thought called Bible criticism. Has anyone heard of Bible criticism? The basic claim of Bible critics is, now the classic claim made by, let's say, religious Jews, is that going back about 3,300 years ago is Mount Sinai. There was a Jewish people, they leave Egypt, right? They go to Mount Sinai, and God begins a 40-year process of dictating the Torah. It's the word of God. Everything that happens in the Bible is basically accurate, historically, and you name it. Bible critics said, whoa, whoa, wait, stop. Let's think rationally. Gods don't write books. Someone had to have written the book. It's made up by a bunch of humans. Okay, intelligent human beings, but nonetheless, it's a humanly authored book. Now, without going into a big treatise on what Bible critics say, because it's not the class. Okay, and by the way, almost any university course you take in America, for instance, on Bible will not be studying, you know, classic biblical commentary from medieval rabbis, but rather you'll be spending a couple semesters talking about the issue of who wrote the book, based on the assumption that it is humanly written. Because the major change that Bible critics put into the whole study of the Bible is, forget the God Moses stuff, that's myths and fairy tales. Rather, between the 9th century BCE and the 5th century BCE, is everyone clear on BCE? If you have any questions, do not hesitate to ask, please. The rabbis teach, an embarrassed person never learns. If you're not clear on something, don't be afraid to ask. Between 2800 and 2400 years ago, much later than the traditional Jewish chronology, okay, a bunch of rabbis and priests, when I say priests, I don't mean the Catholic guys with the white collars. I mean Kohanim. Anyone from a Kohen here? Any Kohanim here? Okay, important. I want to mention Kohanim later also. A bunch of rabbis and priests got together and took all the mythological fairy tales of the ancient Semitic peoples who later became the Jews, collected it into one book, claimed it was the word of God, claimed it was written by a guy named Moses who never existed, and then these very smart rabbis and priests, after putting the book together, foisted it on the Jewish people and got them to buy into the fact that it was the word of God given by this guy Moses. That's a pretty big switch, right? We go from word of the infinite creator of the universe to humanly authored book. Now, by the way, all Bible critics, even the most hostile to the notion of God writing the book, still will admit the Bible is a great work of literature. It's up there with, right, Shakespeare. But it's not the word of God. Let's look at the implications of their thought processes vis-a-vis our class. Now, by the way, all Bible critics, regardless of how hostile they are to the traditional opinion, no one disagrees with the fact that there's lots of predictions in the book. What the book says is what the book says, regardless of who you think authored it. Now, let's follow that a little bit further. For a person who believes, like a religious Jew, that there's a God who gave the book, the creator, sustainer, and supervisor of the universe, dictates this book to Moses, is there any problem for that being to put predictions in his book? Is there any problem with that? No, we see it's not a problem for God to do it. It's part of his job description, right? All-powerful, all-knowing, he can do whatever he likes. That's what being God's all about, right? But for those people who hold that it's merely a product of intelligent rabbis and priests from, you know, 2,500 years ago, there's a big problem with putting predictions in the book. Okay, there's a big danger in that. If you're making up a book, nothing to do with God, you're just a smart human being, but you're going to put predictions in your book and claim it's the word of God, what's the danger in putting predictions in that book? They may not come true. Now, if I was going to make up a religion and write a book that goes along with it, I would certainly expect that if I'm claiming that God wrote the book and that I'm a prophet, I would certainly expect predictions to be in the book. But if I'm merely a human being who has no connection to God, just a smart guy, and I know if my predictions don't come true, no one's going to follow my book, what had those predictions better look like? Think about it. You're going to make up a religion, make up a book, put some prophecies in. Right, vague, excellent. You're going to put very vague prophecies. Anything else you want to put in your book? vague. I would say likely to happen. Right. Likely to, and I would also, by the way, for the sake of selling, you know, the guy got to be a good PR guy. You want to invent a new religion. You want to have a following. Positive. Vague, likely to happen, positive. But I just had a prophetic flash. The sun will rise tomorrow. There's a prediction. Okay, I'm not a prophet. You're not going to be impressed. I could fill a whole book with those predictions, and I would never be wrong, yet I wouldn't be a prophet. You don't like that? Okay, I'm going to give you a place, a time frame, and an event. Sometime in the next 25 years, somewhere in the Middle East, there's going to be a war. You're not impressed. Why not? Right. If I said if the next 25 years is going to be uninterrupted peace and prosperity in the Middle East, you'd say, yeah, right. And as we say in New York, I got a bridge to sell you in Brooklyn. You see those kind of predictions? I could fill up whole books with them. I would never be wrong, yet I wouldn't be a prophet. Is everyone clear on that so far? Okay, how about this one? What's today's date? May 21st of the year 2000. Okay, May 21st of the year 2002, Iraq, believe me, Saddam is going to outlast everyone. To divert attention from his collapsing economy, is going to launch 100 Scud missiles into downtown Tehran to reignite the Iran-Iraq war. Now, if that happens, right, on May 21st of 2002, even if it's only on May 20th, and even if it's 199 Scud missiles and not 200, if you remember this class, I'll be impressed, you're all going to call me up and ask me for tips on the stock market. How did he know? Maybe I'm Saddam, right? Check my mustache. Everyone see the difference? That's a specific, not unlikely. It could happen. You know, they're always the Iraqis are always accusing the Iranians of doing all kinds of horrible things to them and vice versa. How about this one, though? Sometime in the next few years, Iran, which, of course, considers Israel to be the devil incarnate, you know, is going to, in fact, decide that we are God's chosen people, and they're going to make a peace treaty and a military alliance with us. Right. And Hitler's going to have a bar mitzvah. If that happens and you remember the class, you're all going to come back and enroll in my school for prophecy. How did the guy know? Now, let's focus on what we're looking at here. We're looking at vague likely to happen. You'll never be wrong, but it doesn't make me a prophet, versus either specific and or highly unlikely, which is an incredibly dangerous thing to put in your book unless you know what's going to be in the future, which is not something that normal people could know. Are we clear on the difference? So with that in mind now, let's go back. I'd like to do the rest of the presentation as if we're the smart guys in the room about 2,500 years ago putting together our book. Okay, we'll follow along with the train of thought of how Bible critics look at authorship of the Bible. So we'd expect to see, remember our criterion? Vague, likely to happen, positive. Now, I already started on a pretty good track. Join my religion and you'll be around forever. And by the way, if it doesn't come true, you won't be around to ask for your money back. So it's a pretty safe prediction. But therefore, we'd expect to see a series of predictions which will follow along logically, vague, likely to happen, and support our opening thesis here. So let's look at the idea of eternal nation, a nation lasting for a long time. What's the thing that gives a nation its strongest sense of national identity? What's the thing in history that nations go to war for far more than everything else combined?
Land.
Now, religion usually is generally an excuse to steal people's land, by the way. But wars for territory, hands down, take it. Therefore, we would expect that if land is the number one point of identification for a nation, then if we're going to have an eternal nation, it should be eternally on their national homeland. That fits together logically, it makes sense historically, and it's positive. What, in fact, does the author put? We're going to go through exile and dispersion. Join our religion, and you'll be thrown out of your national homeland and scattered. I think they need a new PR firm. But not only that, besides physically killing a nation off, which is the best way of destroying a people, what's the next best way to get rid of a nation?
Take care of
their land and exile. Right. Exile them and scatter them. What'll happen to the people? They're going to assimilate. Okay? But not only that, you know, we talk about, first of all, so we see it's contradictory. Exile and dispersion, totally contradictory to eternal nation. And we're going to see that multiple exiles and a dispersion is unique to the Jewish people alone in human history. Before we do that, let's first see where it's predicted. If you go to page 54, please. Page 54, quote number 1, Leviticus 26:33. And you I will scatter amongst the nations at the point of my drawn sword, leaving your country desolate and your cities in ruins. Sign me up for that religion. Right. Look at quote number 3, Deuteronomy chapter 4, 26 through 27. I appoint heaven and earth as witness for you today that you will be cut off quickly from the land you are crossing the Jordan to acquire. You shall not remain there long, for you shall be wiped out. God shall then scatter you among the peoples, and you shall be left few in number amongst the nations where God will lead you. So first of all, a little bit of historical background to the history of exiles and dispersions. The process of exiling and dispersing conquered peoples is fairly unusual in human history. Only a few empires practiced it. In the ancient world, the ones we know of are Assyria and Babylon, who followed one after the other. Unfortunately, they were our neighbors in what is today Iraq. In the modern world, the only country to make this a state policy is the former Soviet Union. They tried it with places like Chechnya, and look at the problems they're having still. It's a very unusual thing. Between 12, maximum maybe 20 known exiles of an entire people in human history. Very rare when we're talking about the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of nations that have existed. Of the very few nations that were exiled just once, only the Jewish people were exiled more than once. Why? What happened to the very few other nations that were exiled just once? Right, as far as we know, they never came back to be exiled again. They disappeared the first time around. So that in and of itself is very unusual. Multiple exiles. A little crash course in Jewish history in terms of exiles. We know that after King David, talking about 3,000 years ago approximately, unfortunately after King Solomon, his grandson, the kingdom splits during the reign of Rehoboam, which is David's grandson, into two separate kingdoms, like America does in 1860. Big disaster. Okay? And eventually, I don't want to go into all the history, but we know that the Assyrian Empire, which is the major power in this part of the world, exerts its hegemony over both the northern and southern kingdoms. Okay? In about the year 721 BCE, the northern kingdom is beaten in battle and carried away into captivity. I'm simplifying here a little. We just don't have time to go into the details. So that northern kingdom was comprised of 10 tribes, and those 10 tribes go away into captivity. What happens to them? They become known as, in Jewish history, the 10 lost tribes. Where are they? Now, some people say they're in Passaic, New Jersey. There's no proof for that. There's an episode, by the way, of Star Trek, the old generation, for those of us who've been watching television longer than, if you're above the age of 25 or 30 or so. Remember the old generation with Mr. Spock and Captain? By the way, in real life, those guys are both Jewish. Captain Kirk, William Shatner, and Leonard Nimoy. Yeah, Leonard Nimoy was a Cohen in real life. The Vulcan sign is the Cohen sign for blessing the people. I remember there's an episode of Star Trek where the 10 lost tribes come back from outer space and meet Mr. Spock. I, who was not raised religious, that was one of my earliest moments of religious reawakening. A little scientific twist, science fiction bent to it. Okay, that's science fiction. What happened to the 10 lost tribes in real life? What happened to them? They assimilated. It describes in the Jewish Bible where they go. And they assimilated. Some come back, yes, but most disappear because that's the normal pattern. Do you know today there are people all the way out as far as China who claim to be descended from the 10 lost tribes? There are like 15 million Pathans, most of them who live in Afghanistan, who are Muslim fundamentalists with a huge amount of Jewish traditions that claim to be descended from the 10 lost tribes. Can you imagine if they invoke the law of return and decide to come live in Israel again? We'll have like 15 million Mujahideen fighters, you know? Go ahead, Assad, make my day. Okay, they're gone. Okay, in 586, the southern kingdom, Judah, the first temple, it's destroyed. Jews go into exile in Babylon. 50 years later, we return. There's an exile followed by a return. We reestablish second temple period. Then the Greeks come. Then the Romans come. And the Romans especially give the Jews an incredibly hard time. They destroy the second temple. We have the Bar Kokhba uprising in 135 of the Common Era. The situation for the Jews becomes totally unbearable. The Romans embark on a deliberate attempt to wipe the Jewish connection out in the land of Israel, and the Jews go into exile once again. And not only do they go in exile, but this is an exile, unlike the first one, where we all go en masse to Babylon. This one, the Jews just scatter everywhere. It's a fascinating topic. Until today, 2,000 years later, the two most ubiquitous products on the planet Earth, Jews and Coca-Cola. It's unbelievable. You have them everywhere. How did Jews get to places like Australia? It's one of the wildest ideas. So we have exile and dispersion. Okay? And we, you know that one of the biggest problems of being Jewish is besides all the neuroses that comes with being Jewish, is that we have a history that's so weird, yet we think it's normal. And we think everyone else's history should be like ours, to be a people who survives, a nation without a national homeland, for 2,000 years is a completely unique experience in human history. It's unlike any other people. It's not like the Irish. You know, in the mid-19th century, the potato crop in Ireland failed, and half the population more or less left to avoid starvation. But there was always a country of Ireland, and there was lots of Irish living there. We're talking about Israel for thousands of years. No Jewish homeland, virtually no Jews living here. we don't appreciate how weird it is that we're still around. So just maybe to get a little bit more insight into how contradictory exile and dispersion is to eternal nation. If you remember back to Mark Twain's quote, he mentions the Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose filled the planet with sound and splendor. The Greek and Roman followed. They're all gone. If you look at the ancient world and look at all the civilizations, Hyksos, Phoenicians, Babylonians, Mycenaeans, there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of civilizations, all of which are gone today. Okay? Even the greatest empires in human history, like the Romans, who controlled the entire Mediterranean basin, for half a millennia, they're gone. If you go to Italy today, the modern Italians are not the ancient Romans. If you go to the Parthenon today in Greece, outside Athens, the modern Greeks are not the ancient Macedonians of Alexander the Great's time. And certainly the Arabs trying to sell you souvenirs by the Great Pyramids outside of in Gaza are not the ancient Egyptians of 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. Okay, it's not me saying this. Any historian will tell you this. Just look at how the Italians fought in World War II. Look how the Romans fought 2,000 years ago. You know it ain't the same people. But if we look at what happened in general to those people, we'll appreciate how much more amazing it is that we're still around. So what is the three-step process that caused virtually all the ancient nations to disappear? Step number one is, anyone know? That's the last step. First step is, we have generally wars followed by some form of conquest. Okay, conquest. So, no, sorry, I'm generalizing. I can't go to... Now, diseases affected things, but conquest, disease is an equal opportunity killer of people. It doesn't distinguish between who the Romans are and who the Gauls are. And no question, disease is an important factor in human history, but in terms of the disappearance of nations, more or less, the process goes as follows. What happened to the ancient Romans, who dominated the whole world for so long? If you look, the empire shrinks, and then you have all these Germanic tribes being pushed in from Asia into Europe, and they push on the Roman Empire, and eventually they're allowed to cross into the Roman Empire. And before you know it, not only are they sitting in the Roman Empire, but they've conquered the Roman Empire. And Rome is sacked a number of times in the 5th century until eventually it's gone. They depose the last emperor in 476 of the Common Era. So we have conquest. Okay, I come into your country. I conquer you. How do I treat you? I'm obviously superior. Yeah, you're second-class citizens, more or less. It's called dislike of the unlike, discrimination. Now, what can you, as a discriminated, you might be the majority, but I'm dominating your country, what can you as the discriminated population do to escape discrimination? Well, you can try and rebel and throw me out, which may or may not work, but the general process of human history is eventually the two cultures will merge and form a new entity. Like the Italian of today is a mishmash of a lot of other ancient peoples. You can still find the ancient Romans stuck in there somewhere genetically even. That's not the same people anymore. Conquest, discrimination, and assimilation is the process in general that has caused the disappearance of the vast majority of the nations and peoples of the ancient world. Now, the ancient Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptians, were they exiled from their national homelands? No. They stayed in their national homelands, even as a majority of the population, yet their national identity did not survive. How much more so an exiled and dispersed people, meaning we're living as a conquered people in someone else's land as a minority, a clear minority outside of our homeland, the discrimination will be much worse. The pressure to assimilate, overwhelming. This factor alone, based on all normal patterns in history, should have ended the Jewish people. So what do we see? An idea that's totally contradictory to idea number one, and also completely unique. Multiple exiles and a dispersion. Yet we're still here. Okay, so we already got a little problem going. We now, committee sitting in the room 2,500 years ago, have to figure out how a people who's exiled and dispersed is going to continue to survive. Now, by the way, it's interesting. There are people in history, they don't claim to be prophets, but they try and predict what will be in the future. They're called futurists. People like Alvin Toffler, who wrote a book called Future Shock many years ago, Herman Kahn. Now, they're not claiming to have connection with a higher level of intelligence, but they are analyzing patterns, present patterns and past patterns, and trying to extrapolate what will be in the future. If we're sitting in a room, no matter what period of time we are in history, and we're trying to predict what will be in the future, the best way to do that would be to look at other examples, proven examples in history around us. So if we want to figure out how a people who's exiled and dispersed will continue to survive without connecting to some prophecy or something supernatural like that, we would have to look around in the world and see other peoples who have survived. Remember, only a few have. and see why it is they survived, and see if we can borrow from their proven historical pattern and fit it into ours as a proven pattern that already works in history. Now, if that's not clear, I think it'll become clear in just a minute. Let's do the experiment, and if you're not clear what I'm saying, I think you'll figure it out now. Let's look around the world today. We have a little advantage, by the way. We're not living 2,500 years ago. We've seen a lot of history go by. But let's look around the world today. Let's find some ancient nations that are still around today. I mean nations, not races, not Asians, blacks. Nation states that are still around today. Let's see why they survived, what factors enabled them to survive, whereas so few others made it along with them. Okay, and let's see if we can borrow from that and put it into our so-called prediction. Let's do the experiment. What are some ancient nations still around today? If you move to the east of the Middle East, you'll do a lot better than this part of the world. This part of the world is a big mishmash. Sorry? Okay, let's... Tibet, Mongolia, a little... I appreciate something a little... Sorry? Turkey is also not a good country to pick. Move further to the east. Further. China. China's a great one. Who else? Come on, some big exotic eastern countries. India is a great one. Okay, how about the people who make all the cars and electronic goods? Japanese. Okay, let's stop with Japan, China, India. Three ancient cultures still around today. Why is Japan still around when so many other peoples aren't? What? Sorry? Isolation. Very good. They live on an island. Okay, isolation is definitely a factor. Do you know in the 13th century, the Mongols, who had conquered all of Asia, Genghis Khan, that guy, right? The Mongols launched a giant fleet to try and invade Japan. Just like with the Spanish Armada in the 16th century, a storm sunk the Spanish fleet, so too the Mongol fleet was sunk, and 180,000, or not 130, 180, I'm not sure the number, but well over 100,000 Mongol soldiers drowned. You know what the Mongols, you know what the Japanese called the wind that saved Japan? Kamikaze. Right? The same name as those crazy pilots who crashed their planes into aircraft carriers in World War II? I always wonder why those guys bothered to wear helmets. But those guys, you know, kamikaze. Okay, isolation is a factor that can help your country survive. Unfortunately, we can't use that one at all. Why? Because if you look at where Israel sits, forget being isolated. Not only is it not isolated, it's the most strategic piece of real estate in the ancient world. First of all, it sits on the Mediterranean, which is the body of water that everyone navigates in. The Atlantic was the thing, if you sailed too far, you thought you went off a cliff and disappeared into who knows. So it's on the major body of water, but not only that, it's on the land bridge that connects Africa to Asia, which means that every major world power in human history who wanted to conquer is going to march down the coast of Israel or come to Israel directly, which means whoever named Jerusalem City of Peace has like the worst sense of humor in human history. The city's been conquered more than 36 times in 3,000 years. It's the most fought over piece of real estate in the planet Earth, even till today. So forget Japan, China and India. What do they have in common besides a border that explains to a large extent why they survived? Large populations. How many Indians are there in the world today? There's over 900 million. How many Chinese are there in the world today? Even more impressive. Over 1.2 billion. How many people are there in the world? Like 6 billion, as of they said. Remember some day they came up with last May. There are now, with the birth of so-and-so in like, you know, in Venezuela, there are now 6 billion. How do they know that? There are 6 billion people in the world. Anyway, which means what percentage of the world is Chinese? About 20% of the world's population is Chinese, which means statistically one out of every five of you should be speaking Chinese. Don't panic. Now, China went through, you know, all kinds of famines. You name it. China was invaded by the Mongols, by the way. But there were so many Chinese. What happened to the Mongols? They were absorbed into Chinese culture. Yeah.
Some of the ancient China, it used to be they don't have the big, dynasties they used to have in China?
No, they're definitely their government, their political system, things have changed, but they're still there as an identifiable nation state. Not to say they haven't evolved in many respects, but it's more or less the same people. Now, let's look at this a little closer. Okay, so we have this huge group of people. People invade them. Okay, by the way, huge group of people definitely works for the Jewish people. We're on to a pattern here we can use in our class. Anyone know what the first commandment in the Bible is? Be fruitful and multiply. Pru uvru. This is great. We're onto something. It definitely works. It's a proven pattern in history. It's part of the Jewish ideology. And if anyone knows how ultra-Orthodox, the Haredi world, functions, they have a lot of kids, right? Go to the northern part of Jerusalem, the Bible Belt, Me'esharim area, I call it, Kiryat Tzanz, all that place. You'll see that the ultra-Orthodox in Jerusalem make up 12% of the population of the city, but they make up 67% of all children in preschool. You know, 10 to 12, 14 kids a family. This is great. So you have a pattern that works. And not only that, let's throw the Chinese into our model. Let's exile 1,200,000,000 Chinese. Pretty scary thought, right? Try getting a seat on China Airlines for the next 200 years. Forget it. We leave 3,000 in Beijing with three restaurants. The rest go into their own little diaspora, which becomes a huge diaspora. Where are all these Chinese going to go? They're going to go to every major city in the world. Now, Manhattan, Chinatown Manhattan, has doubled in size in like the last 20 years. If one billion Chinese go into exile, the entire island is going to become Chinese, which means even exiled and dispersed, there'll be such a large percentage of every major city, 20, 30, 40%, that they'll survive for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So we now found a factor that we can put in our so-called prediction, which would definitely work. Let's put that there'll be so many Jews in the world that even exiled and dispersed, we will survive. That's a nice in theory. What, in fact, does the author put in? We'll be few in number. It's pretty crazy. First of all, exile and dispersion together with few in number is a guaranteed recipe for what? Extinction, total assimilation. But not only that, few in number is a very unusual pattern in demographics. If you study the rise and fall of nations in human history, you see they go up, they go down, but they don't stay flat, few in number. So it's weird, and it's very contradictory to the notion of eternal nation. Let's see where it's predicted on page 62. Two quotes, both from Deuteronomy. The first is Deuteronomy 28:62. You shall remain few in number, whereas you could have become as numerous as the stars of heaven because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. And quote Deuteronomy 4:27. And you shall remain few in number amongst the nations where God shall lead you. And just to illustrate this graphically, we made a graph for you at the bottom of the page, which, by the way, is proportionally totally not accurate, because from 1000 BCE till 3000 years almost later, 1880, is the same amount of space on the graph as from 1880 to 115 years later, 1995. The real way this graph should look, I would say, is this is about the year 1 of Christian calendar. This is the next 2000 years. This is mid-19th century. This is mid-20th century Holocausts. Okay? You have a huge period of time in the middle, 2,000 years, where there's almost no change in Jewish population. And before we look at that, look at the Chinese, our control group. China, Han Dynasty, one of the first countries to do a census. 200 BCE, how many Chinese are there in the world? 30 million. That is a very large number of people for that period of time in human history. By the way, anyone know when the world hit a billion people, population-wise? Interesting piece of trivia. 1850. From 1850 till 2000, it's gone from 1 billion people to 6 billion people. The population of the world has gone way. They expect it hopefully to level off within the next 100, 150 years. After another half a billion Chinese are born, who knows? That's a side point. But look at our China here. 200 BCE, 30 million people. Now, you can be sure the Chinese had wars, famines, flood, disease, high infant mortality rates, you name it. Yet their population goes right up 2,200 years later to 1,200,000,000 people. Look at the Jewish people. Now, how many Jews are in the world? We, unfortunately, being in diaspora and not having like the United World Jewish Federation of censor takers, do not have an exact number, but many historians have hazarded guesses which are believed to be fairly accurate. For instance, Michael Grant, one of the great classical historians, the Greek and Roman period, he estimates, and I've seen several historians give similar numbers, that living in the Roman Empire about 2,000 years ago, there were something like 6 to 7 million Jews. Now, by the way, the whole Roman Empire of 2,000 years ago was 50 to 55 million people, which means what percentage of the Roman Empire was Jewish? About 12 to 15%. That's a huge number of people. In the Eastern Roman Empire, from Egypt over to the east in the Mediterranean, 20% of the population of the Roman Empire was estimated to be Jewish, which means we in the Roman Empire are like the Chinese in the world. And not only that, there's another million more Jews living outside the Roman Empire in Parthia, in the Persian Empire. So you could easily, without exaggerating, 7 to 8 million Jews in the world 2,000 years ago. Just straight demographics. What do you think demographers estimate, given that there were 7 to 8 million Jews in the world 2,000 years ago? How many Jews should be in the world today? Look at the Chinese, right? 2,200 years ago, 30 million of them. Today, 1,300,000,000. What are the numbers you think are really given by demographers? Anyone want to take a guess as to how many Jews it's estimated should be in the world? 2 billion is too high. It's not more than the Chinese, for sure not. The numbers, the lowest number I've seen is a quarter of a billion, 250 million. The highest number I've seen is 750 million. The median number held by most demographers I've seen is half a billion, 500 million Jews, meaning in the year 2000, the three largest nation states on the planet Earth should be China, India, Jews. Now, granted, by the way, if you ask non-Jews how many Jews are in the world, they will tell you there's a billion of them. Look, they control everything. It's funny. We actually have videos interviewing Gentiles around the world, and the numbers they give are outrageous. They're unbelievable. Half a billion Jews. How many Jews are really in the world today? No, there's more than 6 million. About 12.5 to 14 million, depending upon, you know. That means there's maybe 4 million or so more Jews in the world today than were in the world 2,000 years ago. Do you know the Chinese census here? 1.2. You know the margin of error in that census done in 1990? It was plus or minus a margin of error of 48 million people, which means there are four times more people missing from the Chinese census than are Jews in the world. That the entire population of England is missing from the census. It's incredible. Now, the question is, what happened to all the Jews? Why aren't there 500 million Jews in the world today? Who knows? What happened? Now, anyone, by the way, any of us sitting in the room, we're talking about 120 generations or so, which is all it is from Mount Sinai till the present. That's all the generations in the last approximately 3,300 years. If you're sitting in this room as a Jew today, boy, remember the U.S. Marines used to have a commercial, The Few, The Proud, The Marines? It's much more amazing to be sitting as a Jew in a room in Israel in the early 21st century, I can promise you. Okay. But what happened to all the Jews? Right, looking down history, you all know the game Monday Night Quarterback. When are all the big football games played in America? On Sunday. It's very easy on Monday to replay the game in your mind and figure out how the losing team could have won. So, but in hindsight, that's what it is. We look back and we see that a combination of anti-Semitism and assimilation has taken out a good percentage of the entire Jewish world. Do you know the entire period from the year 1 until here? This 2,000-year period, you know the Jewish population in the world? 1 to 1.5 million, that's all, for the entire Jewish world, for almost 2,000 years, remaining few in number. So in hindsight, we see what happened. But looking up the graph, in foresight, that's, as a prediction, that's where it gets weird. It's one thing to look back, but to predict it forward? So what do we have? An idea which together, few in number, together with exile and dispersion, as we say in baseball jargon, is already two strikes against the Jewish people. Either one of these should have wiped us out. Together, it should have been fatal. And not only that, we see it's a very unusual pattern in human history of demographics. So let's now go back to our team of rabbis and priests in the room 2,500 years ago who now have to figure out how a people who is exiled and dispersed and few in number is going to continue to survive. It's also very negative. There's a lot of negativity coming out of this book. I mean, who's going to join? I have a great idea. I know what I would put in. I would put in that despite an occasional bad guy in human history, on the whole, humanity will absolutely have an incredibly positive relationship with the Jewish people. And they will love and respect us, the Gentile world, so much that no Jew, regardless of where he was in the smallest community at the end of the earth, would ever think to give up his Jewish identity because of all the privileges and the love and respect he gets from the rest of the world for being Jewish. It's a great idea, right? Would that were so. Okay, now Israel Zangwili, who was a British Zionist writer about 100 years ago, he said it perfectly. He said, the Jews are a frightened nation. 2,000 years of Christian love have made us that way. Which brings us, the British have the best sense of humor, definitely. Which brings us to one of the strangest ideas in Jewish history, the concept of anti-Semitism. Which, like everything else in Jewish history, is really in a category by itself. In the horrible world of racial and religious intolerance, it really does stand out. Okay, now, we're not going to look at, in this, we have a presentation in Eish HaTorah called Why the Jews. I highly recommend, you can do it on our website. If you go to www.aish.com and you go to online seminars, you can do online an amazingly interesting seminar called Why the Jews. Because anti-Semitism is such a big topic in Jewish consciousness. It's important to understand the real reason why we're hated, which is not what we're going to get into in the seminar. You can also, by the way, read an excellent book by Dennis Prager, P-R-A-G-E-R, and Joseph Telushkin, which is also called Why the Jews. We're not going to get to that today. But I want to analyze anti-Semitism as a unique phenomenon. And before we do that, let's just do a little review here. We're going to see that anti-Semitism is the longest, most intense, most universal, most irrational hatred in human history. So what do we got here? The nation that's supposed to outlast everyone else is going to be exiled and dispersed, few in number, and hated for the longest period by more people, more intensely than any other people in human history, yet we're going to survive? Pretty weird. And we're going to see that anti-Semitism is a very unusual phenomenon. So let's first look at the predictions of anti-Semitism. If you go to page 58, look at quote number one from Leviticus 26, chapters 36 through 38. "And those of you who survive in the land of your enemies, I shall make so faint-hearted that if leaves rustle behind them, they will flee headlong as if from the sword, though no one pursues them, stumbling over one another as if to escape a weapon while no one is after them. So helpless will you be to take a stand against your foes. You shall perish amongst the nations, and the land of your enemies shall consume you." Sign me up for that religion. Look at quote number two, Deuteronomy chapter 28, 32 through 37. Look at the third paragraph, which is actually 65 through 67. "Amongst those nations you shall find no respite, no rest for your foot. Their God will make you cowardly, destroying your outlook and making life hopeless. You will live in constant suspense. Day and night you will be terrified, never sure of your existence. In the morning you will say, 'If only it were night,' and in the evening you will say, 'If only it were morning.' Such will be the dread that your heart will feel and the sight that your eyes will see." Pretty glum. Sorry?
What is that written in?
Where is this written?
Yeah.
It's in the Bible, and you have your book. It says right here in Deuteronomy. The question is, what's the context of these predictions, especially in Deuteronomy? There's a huge number of prophecies predicted. It's Moses reviewing before he dies, before the Jewish people enter the land of Israel. He's reviewing it and saying this is a warning. Now, by the way, it's very important. You're asking, people are dancing around a very important question about prophecy from the Jewish perspective now. Judaism teaches, by the way, that a bad prophecy is a warning that can be avoided if you do the right thing. A good prophecy will come true. It doesn't have to be. You're not locked in here. We have free will to affect our destiny, but if we do the wrong thing, we're guaranteed that this will happen. And unfortunately, as we see when you learn from Jewish history, my favorite quote about Jewish history is, or history in general, is one thing we learn from history is we don't learn from history. We Jews are terrible history students. So we didn't make the right decisions, and unfortunately, we've taken all the wrong paths, and you can see these predictions, even if you're not a big scholar of Jewish history, these very scary predictions are remarkably accurate predictions of what the Jewish people have gone through, especially in places like medieval Europe. Without going into the real reason for anti-Semitism, let's look at it as a weird phenomenon first. What's the definition? Let's begin. Very important to digress for a minute. Definition of anti-Semitism is... against Semitic peoples. First of all, who's a Semite? Semitic, where's the word come from? Shem. Okay, Noah has three sons. Shem, Ham, Yafet. Shem, Sem, that's the anglicized version of Semitic. Middle Eastern peoples are all Semitic people. So someone who hates an Arab, is he an anti-Semite? Do we agree? No. But do we agree the definition anti-Semite is against Semitic peoples? Does anyone have another definition? Against Jews. The correct answer is anti-Semitism is prejudice or hostility towards Jews. And it's a very important distinction. The word was invented by a German Jew hater by the name of Wilhelm Marr, M-A-R-R, in 1879. Anything Hitler... No, he was not Jewish. Anything that Hitler... Although every anti-Semite always claims he's Jewish somewhere. Hitler was... Who knows? Anything Hitler says and the Nazis say in the 20th century, it was echoed much more intelligently and clearly, believe it or not, by earlier racial thinkers in the 19th century. Karl Marie Düring, Wilhelm Marr. When you read what they write, it's much scarier, actually. Okay? Marr wrote a book called The Victory of Judaism Over Germandom, which went into six printings very rapidly in the late 19th century. It was a big seller. And he wanted to make hatred of the Jews sound more racial, because this was the period of Darwin and racial theory and race and Nietzsche and all that stuff. More racial, less religious. So he invents a word called anti-Semitism. Now, what's weird about it is even until today, it's the only form of racial or religious intolerance that has its own word to describe it. If you hate a black, what are you?
Racist.
You're a racist. If you hate an Asian, what are you?
Racist.
Same thing. You're certainly not politically correct. You're not an anti-Asian or an anti-black. That immediately should get us thinking there's something pretty weird about this phenomenon, that it's the only form of racial religious intolerance that has its own word to describe it. And so weird is the whole phenomenon of anti-Semitism and all the different aspects of it that it has a whole vocabulary that had to be invented to go along with it. The lexicon of anti-Semitism: Holocaust, pogrom, ghetto, blood libel. Even the word genocide, which everyone loves to throw around today, genocide in Rwanda, genocide in you name it. Where does it come from? Anyone know Greek and Latin? It's a weird word. It's part Greek, part Latin. Genos from the Greek word people, side, like insecticide, from the Latin word to kill. The word was invented in 1943 by a Polish-Jewish doctor, Raphael Lemkin, refugee escaping from the Holocaust in Europe, arrives in England, and he says, and I quote, "There is a crime happening in Europe that there is no word to describe." And he invents a word, genocide. Because that's the phenomenon of the systematic destruction of an entire people for no other reason than who they are, unprecedented. Like everything else in Jewish history, totally weird. And there are a lot of other aspects of anti-Semitism that make it strange. If you turn back to page 57 and look at the quote at the top of the page, the big letter H. "History provides us with far too many examples of man's inhumanity to man. Social injustice, religious oppression, cultural clashes, ideological wars, class hatred, and most every other form of racism and intolerance. One particular form, however, stands out amongst all others. Anti-Semitism, unique in its universality, intensity, longevity, and irrationality, anti-Semitism is a historical phenomenon which falls outside of normal sociological bounds." Now, to put that sentence in simple English, the world is full of racial and religious intolerance, but there are four specific aspects of anti-Semitism that set it apart. Like everything else in human history, when it relates to the Jews, it's got to be weird and different. What are those four things? Very briefly, number one is universality, which doesn't mean, by the way, every human being on the planet Earth is a Jew hater. I mean, there's a limit to Jewish paranoia, right? But what's interesting about hatred of Jews is that, unlike hatred of other peoples, you know, you take Bosnians and Serbs out of where they live and you put them somewhere else, they'll probably disappear and do fine. Well, no matter where we go, whatever population we find ourselves amongst, regardless of their race or their religion, anti-Semitism will surface without exception. It follows us everywhere. It's universal. Number two is the level of intensity. Now, the dictionary definition of anti-Semitism, it's prejudice or hostility towards Jews. And would that that were all that anti-Semitism was. Like, we can't get into a couple of country clubs and a couple of, you know, universities. Remember that great Groucho Marx line? "I wouldn't want to be the member of any country club that would have me as a member." We know it's much worse than that. The history of anti-Semitism is one long, horrifying list of punitive taxation and expulsion and rape and pillage and beatings and humiliation and you name it, up to what's the worst thing you could do to people you hate? Kill them. Kill them. Genocide. And believe me, there have been more attempts to wipe the Jews off the face of the earth than probably everyone else in the world combined in human history. As far back as we go in human history, we find people being so incredibly threatened by the Jewish people, they have to kill us. And by the way, that leads us to an incredibly interesting question. What could it possibly be that we are doing, the little Jewish people, we're pretty nice, that makes people feel so threatened that they have to kill us? I don't want to answer that, so I'm asking a rhetorical question. You'll have to do the Why the Jews seminar to get an answer to that. But if you look, the story of Passover is an attempted genocide of the Jewish people in Egypt 3,300 years ago. The story of Purim 2,500 years ago in the Persian Empire, another attempted genocide. And we have the Crusades. And we have Bogdan Khmelnytsky. People know Khmelnytsky massacre, 1648, 1649. No one even knows about the guy. Ukrainian nationalist leader kills over 100,000 Jews in a two-year period. Adolf Hitler. And so many other examples, it's unbelievable. There's a book you can get called Day by Day in Jewish History. It's the most depressing book I've ever seen. All it is a list of every single date in the Jewish calendar and what happened on that date. And 85% of the list is, and Jews killed here, Jews expelled there. It's so depressing. But it shows you how an incredibly long and intense phenomenon it is. That's number two that sets it apart. Number three, longevity also sets anti-Semitism apart. We are one of the oldest, if not the oldest nation around. And for as long as we've been around, anti-Semitism has been around to haunt us. When the BBC did a program, believe me, they're no like super friend of the Jewish people or Israel, but they produced some amazing television. When they did a program on anti-Semitism, you know what they called it? Anti-Semitism, the longest hatred, because it is. And last but not least, and the weirdest of all, is the idea of irrationality, the reason why Jews are hated. And this is a very strange phenomenon. You know, if you ask a white supremacist to put on the board why he hates black people, he'll give you a list of like 10 horrible stereotype things black people supposedly do. If you ask a group of anti-Semites to put on the board why they hate Jews, they'll fill up 16 whiteboards. because they're capitalists, because they're communists, because they're warlike, because they're pacifists, because they're different, because they're the same, because they're rich, because they're poor. Professor Michael Curtis of Rutgers University, he said it perfectly. Anything and everything is a reason to hate the Jew. Whatever you hate the Jew is that. That's wild. Whatever you hate the Jew is that. You can say anything. Hold on one second. You could say anything about the Jewish people and people will believe it. You had a question?
It seems like if we do what God wants, everyone's going to hate us. And if we don't do what God wants, everyone's going to hate us.
No.
Seriously?
No, as a matter of fact, I don't think you read the Bible carefully then. God makes it very clear. He says, you do what I want, no one will bother you. If you don't do what I want, then everyone's going to give you a hard time. That's the predictions. I can guarantee you. Go read the Bible carefully. It's the most repeated idea in the entire Bible. Do what you're supposed to do, you'll have no problems. Don't do it, and boy, you can have, as we say in Yiddish, tzuris. But just to go back to the idea of irrational for just a second, just to give you a couple of examples. Now, again, I'm dancing around the issue. I'm not going to get to it, of the real reason. But you can say anything about the Jews. It's amazing. In medieval Europe, you know, think about it. People thought of outrageous accusations, things that are so far from anything logical. For instance, starting in Norwich, England, in the mid-12th century, Jews who have a commandment not to eat blood are, of course, accused of what? Kidnapping a Christian baby to use that baby's blood. Kill the baby and drain the body of blood. Now, why in medieval Europe do you think they believed Jews needed blood? Multiple choice question. A, as a punishment for killing Jesus, all Jews suffer from hemorrhoids, and the best cure for hemorrhoids before Preparation H is drinking Christian baby's blood. B, all Jews need Christian baby's blood to make matzah, which is the chief ingredient. C, all Jewish men menstruate and need a monthly blood transfusion. D, Jewish boys, when they're circumcised, lose so much blood, they replenish it by drinking Christian baby's blood. E, all of the above. E, all of the above. Unless you think that that's only something that happens in the very superstitious and poorly educated population of medieval Europe, I can show you examples in 1990 of, you know, in Minnesota, people distributing leaflets about Jewish blood libels. It's alive and well in the world today. You can say, as Michael Curtis said, anything and everything is a reason to hate the Jew. Whatever you hate the Jew is that. It's a level of irrationality that is mind-blowing. Now, we didn't get to the real reason. I'm deliberately not talking about it now because it's outside the scope of this presentation. But I highly recommend doing Why the Jews to see that. But just to focus on what we're looking at here, we're talking about this incredibly intense, violent, universal hatred, which stands out as a huge flashing light, unique, right? Together with few in number, an exile and dispersion. Again, back to our baseball terminology, 1-2-3 strikes, and the Jewish people should definitely be out. Okay? Now let's switch gears a little bit. Look at number 5. What would you expect, by the way, to see from a people who's gone through such a history? I wouldn't expect too much. The fact that we survive, as Pascal said at the beginning of the class, is supernatural. The author is not content to have us just, despite all these strikes against us, to have us survive. But he wants us, the little teeny Jewish people that everyone hates, to change the world. Which brings us to idea number 5, which in the context of everything we've seen before is so crazy. It's the idea of light to nations. Light to nations. The little teeny Jewish people shouldn't even be here, and everyone hates our guts. We're going to change the world. Okay, what does it mean, first of all? This is, by the way, the topic that if I'm an expert at anything, it's this topic. I wrote a seminar called World Perfect, The Jewish Impact on Civilization. I wrote a book on the topic. It's a fascinating, fascinating topic. I'm going to give you a few minutes of it, but if you like the idea, you can go onto the webpage again, onto online seminars, look up World Perfect, and you can get a lot more information on it. And I hope the book will be out soon, too. Buy a copy, come back. I'll be happy to autograph it for you. Okay, so first let's look at where this is predicted. Go to page 63, please. Page 63, quote number 1, God speaking again back to Abraham, the proto-Jew. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. You shall become a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Through you, all the communities of the earth shall be blessed. So God says to Abraham, and therefore to us, the Jewish people, his descendants, the entire world is going to be changed by you, the Jews. What does that mean? Turn over to page 64, please. Look at the prophet Isaiah from 2,500 years ago. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. and I will hold your hand and keep you, and I will establish you as a covenant of the people for a light unto nations. Isaiah 42:6. And look at Isaiah 60. This is where he explains what this means. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and a thick darkness the nations. But God will shine upon you. Nations shall then go by your light, and kings by your radiant illumination. Give me a break. I mean, are we talking about like, hello? Are we talking about the same people here? Nations and kings who hate our guts. I mean, think of, it's a pretty weird idea. You know, you ask little kids who they want to be like when they grow up, and they'll tell you they want to be like people they respect. You don't hear, you know, little Jewish kids saying, when I grow up, I want to be like Ayatollah Khomeini, Adolf Hitler, and Saddam Hussein. In the eyes of the non-Jewish world throughout history, the Jew was evil, in league with the devil, subhuman. Who's going to listen to us? And not only that, you know, we had a big empire somewhere. We forced our belief. It's a very, very, we're talking about a people who's exiled and dispersed, few and none. It's so weird. How are we going to influence anyone? We're not even going to survive according to the laws of history. So then the obvious question is, besides great Jewish contributions to history, like guilt, bagels, junk bonds, leverage buyouts, Einstein, Marx, Freud, 22% of all Nobel Prizes in science since 1900, and all the other wonderful things that we all take so much Jewish pride in, what is the light that we've been to nations? What is the idea that we've given to the world that has changed the world, I would say, arguably more than any idea in human history? What's the great Jewish contribution to civilization? Monotheism. I would say that's half the answer. Very good. I would put the word ethical before the word monotheism. The belief in one God, creator, sustainer, supervisor of the universe. No other powers besides. And from that God comes one standard of right and wrong. Okay? Ethical monotheism. An idea which is, today we can appreciate, has had an incredible impact on human history. Again, if you look at the World Perfect Seminar, you can get a lot more information on that. But an idea which in the ancient world was totally incomprehensible. In the ancient world, everyone was a polytheist, believing in multiple gods. Okay? And because of that, because there was no one God, there was no one standard of morality, the behavior of the ancient world was absolutely horrifying, even the great empires like Greece and Rome. Check out World Perfect for more gruesome details on that topic. Into this polytheistic world, almost 4,000 years ago, out of a place which we now today know as Iraq, we used to call it Ur, arguably one of the last good things to come out of that part of the world, comes a man by the name of Abraham. And Abraham is great for two reasons. One, in a world that's entirely polytheistic, using the power of his intellect, he comes to the realization of one God, an idea which is totally incomprehensible and unacceptable to the rest of the world. Now, the true greatness of Abraham is, despite the fact that no one else is going to buy into that idea and think him crazy for even speaking it, Abraham dedicates himself to bringing that idea into the collective consciousness of all of humanity. Abraham says, I choose to dedicate my life to bring the idea of God and one standard of morality into the world, because without that, the human race is going to eat each other alive. That's, by the way, what we say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad is all about. The watchword of our faith, that's our Jewish mantra, our battle cry. God is it. That's reality. An incredible idea. An idea which now we, looking at in hindsight, can see has changed the world. Go back to page 50. Just I want to show you one example of one person who appreciates the power of this idea. This is John Adams, second president of the United States. And he says, in spite of Bolingbroke and Voltaire, I'll insist the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. If I were an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. If I were an atheist of another sect who believed or pretended to believe that all is ordered by chance, I should believe that chance had ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of all morality and consequently of all civilization. Skip to the underlined part below. They are the most glorious nation that ever inhabited this earth. The Romans and their empire are but a bubble in comparison of the Jews. They have given religion to three quarters of the globe and have influenced the affairs of mankind more and more happily than any other nation, ancient or modern. And if he were running for president, I would definitely vote for the guy. And by the way, I can show you, if you go to World Perfect, they have dozens of quotes, similar people saying more or less the same thing. The Jewish people civilized the world. So we come into the world and we bring this idea of God. And that's, by the way, this whole idea of light into nations. What's it all about? We say, that Abraham says, I choose to live, he says to God, I choose to live with the reality of you. And God says to Abraham, Abraham, you're choosing me, then I choose you back. This is that chosen people idea which no one understands. What are we chosen for? Not privilege. It's a big privilege to be Jewish, but we're not chosen for privilege. We're chosen for responsibility. What's the responsibility? We call it in Hebrew, tikkun olam. Fix the world. How's that for a cause? Beats the heck out of save the whales. It's the ultimate cause in human history of being a people who is a living embodiment of relationship with God and God-given values of peace, love, justice, the brotherhood of mankind. We're supposed to teach the world by example. That is our responsibility in human history. Now, the last little part, we're running through this very quickly, but the last little part of the riddle is, you know, I started out by saying, how are we, the Jewish people, going to influence anyone? We don't believe in proselytizing. It's not a Jewish thing. We understand how the Greeks and Romans spread their ideas around. They conquered the world. We understand how Christianity and Islam spread. They actively supported converting people to their religion. We Jews, we don't believe in converting people. We make it very difficult to convert, as a matter of fact. And we certainly never had a great empire. Okay, Hollywood, definitely, yes. Brooklyn, possibly. But nothing. How do we? The whole world, as John Adams said, has been incredibly powerfully influenced by the Jews. How did we do it? So again, the process is fascinating and very detailed, but in a nutshell, for 2,000 years, from Abraham to the birth of Christianity, it was Jews versus everyone else in the world. The only monotheist on the planet Earth and the whole rest of the world saying, you Jews, you're out of your mind, and hating us for it. And then, after the entire world telling us we're crazy, we have two offshoot religions that come out of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, one after the other, both offshoots of Judaism, that are going to convert ultimately billions of people from being amoral polytheists to people who basically buy into a worldview that comes from the Jewish people. Any believing Christian or Muslim will tell you, there's one God, creator, sustainer, and supervisor of the world. There's one standard of morality for all humanity. He gave the Jewish people Torah at Mount Sinai, and then he changed his mind and chose us instead. That's a different problem. And by the way, you know the big spreader of Jewish ideas in the world outside of other religions that have come out of Judaism? Like, how does Jewish values get to places that are not necessarily monotheistic? What's the most potent political force of the last 200 years? Democracy. And anyone who studies the history of democracy will see clearly the founding fathers of democracy in England and America in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries were all people who were overwhelmingly fueled by a vision of the world that was based on one God and one standard of morality. Look at the Declaration of Independence of America, and you see it very clearly. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that amongst these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. God gives basic rights that no human being can play with. Such an interesting story. I didn't do it justice in the few minutes I had. But in the context of everything else we've been through, the little Jewish people who shouldn't even be here and everyone hates have influenced the world in ways that are so profound. So profound. You look at Thomas Cahill's book, The Gift of the Jews, which I think is a really bad book. But it's like three or four pages in that book that are unbelievably good. And he says that virtually everyone on the planet Earth, when I say a bad book, most of the focus of the book is not what I would have written the book on. But a couple of pages, he basically says that virtually everyone on the planet Earth, we wake up, we think Jewish. The Jewish people have influenced in so many ways, often subliminally, how we view our world today. It's an amazing topic. Now, topic 6 and 7, we're almost out of time. So 6 and 7 are really the flip sides of each other. 6 is, in terms of science, I would say the strangest idea in the whole class. The interdependency of, I'm going to abbreviate here, JP is Jewish people and LI is land of Israel. The interdependency of the Jewish people and the land of Israel. I'll define what we're talking about in just a second. Before I do that, please go to page 65. You don't have to go anywhere, actually. We're right on the page if you didn't close your books. The Bible describes, by the way, in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and many other sources, the Bible describes how beautiful and green the land of Israel is. Eretz Zavat Chalav V'Davash, a land flowing with milk and honey. Okay, so we already talked about, when we're talking about exile and dispersion, few in number, we already mentioned the fact that Israel is an incredibly strategically important piece of real estate, right? Sitting on the land bridge that connects Asia to Africa, on the Mediterranean. So we have, it already establishes its worth as a strategically valuable piece of real estate. And now we see that it's also economically and agriculturally very valuable. Look at the middle of the page. This is a quote from Flavius Josephus, the great first century Jewish historian. This is page 65. See where it says fertility of the land? Look at the letter F. What does Josephus say about the land of Israel? For the whole area is excellent for crops or pasturage and rich in trees of every kind, so that by its fertility it invites even those least inclined to work on the land. In fact, every inch of it has been cultivated by the inhabitants, and not a parcel goes to waste. And I've actually met agricultural historians, there is such a topic, who have told me that the land of Israel is the most extensively cultivated piece of real estate in the Mediterranean basin. Which means 2,000 years ago, not only was this an incredibly important strategic piece of real estate, but it was a beautiful, green, lush, economically very valuable piece of real estate. Much, 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 much greener than it is today. So therefore, what are you as world conqueror, Caesar, Alexander, Pharaoh, you name it, what are you going to want to do when you come to the land of Israel? Sorry? Conquer it. Maybe get rid of the original inhabitants. Certainly bring in your own colonists. Settle the land. Stay there permanently. Absorb this piece of real estate strategically and economically into your empire and stay there forever. That's the ideal. Ah, that's what we'd expect to happen normally. But, you know, in Jewish history, nothing's normal. The author of the book says, you know, this interdependency thing, the land of Israel has a special relationship with the Jewish people. We're not talking about Zionism or nationalism. The land, get a load of this one, the land reacts differently to the Jews than to other people. What? Meaning, when Jews are there, since the land was given specially to them, when Jews are living in the land, it's like a mother with her children. When the children are home, mommy is happy. Okay? When they disappear for a long period of time, mommy gets all depressed and she's barren. The land reacts differently for the Jews. It's a pretty weird idea, but that's exactly what's predicted. Go to page 66, please. Look at 1a on the top of the page. So devastated will I leave the land. This is Leviticus 26. Will I leave the land that your enemies who live there will be astonished, your land will remain desolate, and your cities in ruins. Look at quote number 4, Ezekiel 33, chapters 28 through 29. And I shall make the land a desolate waste so that its proud strength will cease. The mountains of Israel shall be desolate. No one will cross them. Okay, the land will be barren. And we look, by the way, if you look at the decline of Israel agriculturally, you'll see exactly that. Beginning during the last 2,000 years with the Roman occupation of Israel, as Roman persecution increases, first during the Roman Empire, then during the Roman Christian Byzantine Empire, the Jewish population is going to flee the country, go into exile. And along with the departure of the Jews by about 1,500 years ago, with almost all Jewish population disappearing, there's never a period of time there were no Jews here, the land goes into incredible decline, despite the fact that many other people come in afterwards, till the point when 130 years ago, Mark Twain, our agnostic friend, is traveling through here, and he writes his book, Innocents Abroad. Look at the top of page 67, look at Mark Twain's description. We traverse some miles of desolate country whose soil is rich enough but is given wholly to weeds. A silent, mournful expanse. A desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We reached Tabor safely. We never saw a human being on the whole route. We pressed on toward the goal of our crusade, renowned Jerusalem. The further we went, the hotter the sun got, and the more rocky, bare, repulsive, and dreary the landscape became. There was hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive and cactus, those fast friends of the worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. No landscape existed as more tiresome to the eye than that which bounds the approaches to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is mournful, dreary, and lifeless. I would not desire to live here. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. Very, by the way, biblical language for Mark Twain, our agnostic friend. But he's hit the nail right on the head. He's saying the land is in mourning for the loss of her people. Has anyone ever heard of such a concept? Totally weird. Land doesn't distinguish between who's living on it. It's not an animate object. I mean, on some level it is. It's like the ecosystem. But it's not like a thing with consciousness. This is a very strange phenomenon. And by the way, a huge, huge, huge blessing in disguise. What do I mean? Take the United States. Go back 300 years. 300 years ago, the United States was occupied by something like maximum half a million people. We used to call them Indians. Now we call them Native Americans, who, by the way, were Stone Age people, more or less. No metal, nothing. Stone Age. Okay, but they were very connected to their environment. They didn't pollute, you name it. In comes those naughty white guys from Europe. And they kill off most of the Native Americans. And they pollute like crazy. And they exterminate many of the animal species. Does America turn into a desert wasteland because the indigenous population that is so profoundly connected to the land has been destroyed? Culturally, arguably, yes. But economically, certainly not. America becomes the greatest economic superpower in human history, certainly in the modern world. Why? Because land doesn't care who's living on it. What chance do you think the Native Americans have of getting the United States back and creating their own country and throwing the white guys out? I have much better chance of being president of America, and I would not place very high odds on that. What chance do you think, this is the blessing in disguise, that the Jewish people, after a much longer and much more difficult history, would go into exile, survive for 2,000 years without their national homeland, then come back 2,000 years later and find the land sitting basically empty, waiting for them? If it had been a beautiful, lush, lovely place, there'd be no chance. But it's sitting there, waiting, empty. Huge blessing in disguise. Okay, so this is a very weird phenomenon, yet looking back, we see it's exactly what happened. And we'll look at the flip side in just a minute when we get to number 7, which is the end. And number 7 is the happy ending, more or less happy, one of the few positive things we've seen, unfortunately, today, which is the idea of return, the return of the Jewish people. And again, this is a phenomenon which is really totally unique in human history. No people ever lost their homeland, went into exile 2,000 years, came back, reestablished the same piece of real estate, and recreates a state on it. Okay, unique phenomenon in human history, yet one that is predicted over and over and over again. If you look at page 68, 1 Deuteronomy 30, top of the page, number 1, verses 3 through 5. And the Lord your God shall return you from your captivity and have compassion upon you. He shall return and gather you from among all the nations. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land your fathers inherited. You will acquire it, and he will make you even more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. And look at Jeremiah number 4, verse 31, 6 through 7. For thus says God, shout with joy for Jacob, exalt at the heads of nations, proclaim your praise and say, O God, deliver your people, the remnant of Israel. Behold, I will bring them back from the northern lands and gather them from the ends of the world. Now again, we talk about how hard it is to get perspective on Jewish history because it's so supernatural and we take it as normal. We don't appreciate this phenomenon of return. Do you know, 100 years ago exactly, in the year 1900, now today Israel has more than 40, it's close to 6 million Jews living in the country, 5,000,000-something Jews living in the country, but 40% of the world's Jewish population lives in Israel. Within the next 10, probably to 20 years maximum, for the first time in human history, the last 2,500 years, the majority of the Jews of the world will be in the land of Israel, God willing. As a matter of fact, there are more Jews living here today by far than were living here during the Second Temple period. In the entire Second Temple period, you didn't have 40% of the Jewish population living here. You have a question?
So, in terms of return, are we sure that this is it? We're back?
Well, sure, nothing sure. You know what they say, it ain't over till a fat lady sings? We don't know. Hold on. Well, I'm not going to get into predictions what will be. Again, if I was a prophet, I'd be working in Wall Street, so I can't predict what will be.
Isn't that same statistic, using statistics against us as well as far as assimilation goes?
No, I'm not saying the situation of the Jewish world doesn't have its negative side too. But let's just look at the demography of the modern state of Israel to appreciate how unique it is. Okay, so we're talking about 40% of the world's Jewish population, except for New York area, the United States in general, is the largest Jewish population in the world. 100 years ago, forget 40% of the Jewish population living here, 99.99999% of the Jewish world lived everywhere else. What was Israel? A backwater, totally underpopulated, economically underdeveloped, desertified, rotting province of the decrepit Ottoman Turkish Empire with virtually no Jews here. It's unbelievable to now be in a situation where there's so many Jews. We don't appreciate it. You know what's great about this prophecy? You can see it coming true before your eyes. Go to the airport and watch a plane full of Soviet Jews from the former Soviet Union coming back to the land of Israel. We're talking about a million of these people have come in the last 10 years. These are people who have no connection to Judaism, no connection to Zionism, yet coming back by the hundreds of thousands as if drawn by some great historical magnet back to their homeland. You know the population of Israel in the last 60 years, talking about Israel's been a state for 52 years, has gone up 750 times, the Jewish population. It's incredible. It's absolutely unbelievable. And along with that, look at the flip side. Remember, let's go back to number 6. If the land is barren when the Jewish people are gone, what happens when the Jewish people return? Look at page 69, number 7, Ezekiel 36, 8 through 11. As for you, O mountains of Israel, you shall shoot forth your branches and bear your fruit for my people Israel, for their return is close at hand. For behold, I am with you, and I shall turn to you. Then you shall be tilled and sown. I will multiply men upon you, the entire family of Israel. Jews return, the land blooms again. You know the Ministry of Tourism, for years, you know their motto for Israel was? Israel, the miracle on the Mediterranean. That's such an apt, label for this country. the land of Israel. Remember, a desert wasteland with no population, no infrastructure, economic or industrial, any kind. The population explodes. And the country goes, imagine a country trying to absorb 750% increase in population in like 60 years. And the constant state of warfare and economic embargo in a desert. You know, Israel went in 50 years, excuse me, less than 50 years, 49 years, it went from a totally underdeveloped wasteland to in 1997, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, took Israel off the list of developing nations and put it in as a fully developed first world country with a standard of living that is either 18th or 19th highest in the world, right behind that of Great Britain. Yet in a constant state of warfare and terrorism and economic embargo and you name it, and a country trying to be run by a bunch of Jews, forget a bunch of Jews trying to run anything, it is unbelievable. And by the way, it doesn't mean Jew gets off the plane at Ben-Gurion Airport and he walks and flowers bloom behind him. We should be so lucky. But it means that when we come here, the land will bloom for us. Okay, it will work. What other people try doesn't work. It's an unbelievable phenomenon. You know who summed up this class better than anyone else? And before we just talk about that, just to think, we're about to end, but just think on a little bit more of a, I would say, emotional, philosophical level here. We, again, I said the problem being Jewish is we think for us what is normal for everyone else. And the problem of being a Jew in the modern world is not having the perspective to realize what we've gone through. Because most Jews in the world today, especially in the West, we've been alive when the state of Israel has existed. We come from affluent, well-educated backgrounds. Imagine, put yourself, for those of us, and most of us are Ashkenazic Jews of Eastern European descent, put yourself in the mindset of your great-great-great-great-grandparents, okay, who were living 200 years ago in Tsarist Russia, in the largest ghetto on the planet Earth, 386,000 square miles, where 5 million Jews are living in Tsarist oppression and poverty. Imagine what they would have felt to know that in 200 years, their great-great-great-grandchildren will be sitting in the old city of Jerusalem. 100 yards from the Western Wall, something they would have given their whole lives just to touch for a minute before they died. And not just here as tourists. In a Jewish country with a Jewish army and Jewish government, we got a lot of problems here, believe me. Nothing more depressing than reading the newspaper in this country. But we don't appreciate how everything involved in Jewish history is supernatural. It just defies all the laws of history. And I said before, you know who sums this class up better than anyone else I've ever seen? The first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, whose real name is David Green from Plunsk, Poland. Here's a boy who was born religious, became secular, you know, not a big lover of, you know, traditional Jewish lifestyle, but someone who definitely appreciated the Bible and Jewish history. You know what Ben-Gurion said? He said it beautifully. He said, a Jew who doesn't believe in miracles is not a realist. How's that for a quote? How could he say that? A Jew who doesn't believe in miracles is not a realist? I know why he could say it, because anyone who looks at Jewish history clearly sees that Jewish history is one long miracle. It violates all the laws of history. It's supernatural. It's one collection of phenomenon after phenomena. Each and every one of them is either totally unique or highly unusual, combining together to make a history unlike anyone else's history. And on top of that, it's all predicted. And we now, living thousands of years later, can see that those predictions either have come true or they're in the process of coming true. Certainly it shows me that the hand that wrote the book is the hand that controls the historical process. And it also shows me that history acts as awesome outside verification for the predictions in the Bible. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to HAudio.com. For information about our online services, visit our website. To contact one of our representatives, write to HAudio@HAudio.com. Shalom from Jerusalem.